Hi, welcome to the Design Thinking Roundtable, a podcast which explores various aspects of design and how it can create change and social impact. I'm Anne Fayard, an ethnographer who researches, teaches, and practices human-centered design with a focus on social innovation and collaboration. And I love having conversations on design with passionate and mindful designers.
Laetitia Wolf is a creative strategist and design curator. She lives, works, and teaches in the south of France following 20 plus years spent in New York. She consults and creates projects that generate new discourses, meaningful practices, and experiences using design as a tool for social change and innovation. Laetitia brings design to cities for research action projects, curated programs, and citizen engagement initiatives. She currently teaches at BZign, the Sustainable Design School, design impact and partnership-based courses to imagine the creative strategies for tomorrow's territories. Laetitia also wrote several books such as Massin and Real Photo Postcards.
Thanks, Laetitia, for joining us today. I'm looking forward to discussing your work at the intersection of design, social change, innovation, and impact. Can you tell me about a specific event or person that was a key moment in your journey?
Yes, hello, and thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm very happy and honored to be invited. I always say that I've kind of fell in the marmite of design, not having been trained officially as a designer. So I sort of fell into it by working with designers. And I think that's what has sort of, decolored on my own vision of the world. And one of the first person I suppose I should mention in my life is Gaetano Pesce, the Italian architect whom I had the pleasure of working with in New York. I ended up, basically leading his studio for about 3 or 4 years. He's a pretty famous architect who spans the sort of 60s in Italy, really part of this new movement, post-war, experimenting with materials, not just resin, which he has made a sort of signature material for himself, but also expanding foam and all kinds of. He worked with the best furniture makers and has dabbed into art and design and chair design and architecture. So really like the sort of Italian progetto, as they say, where you can think from the kitchen spoon to the city. You know, the scale doesn't really matter. And I had to support him in all kinds of roles to be the interface with the media, because he was very connected to the press, but also help him build special projects in France, where he was often commissioned to design site-specific installations. So we were interacting with museums, and we ended up building his retrospective at the Pompidou Center. So that was my first bath. Because this is an important person for me, I suppose, in my training, in my understanding of where design can go, what are the boundaries between disciplines, and the lack of connectivity sometimes between those creative disciplines. And I would say the other person that has completely informed my understanding of what I do, and both from a sort of content standpoint about design, but also an approach to learning, is Massin. Massin was the creative director for Gallimard, the French publisher, for more than 25 years. So he really shaped our visual culture of book. I mean, every book you probably grew up with, he designed the cover of. And he also, aside from this sort of institutional full-time job, continued side projects that he was passionate about. And that was about expressive typography. So he started to experiment in stretching, literally, physically and metaphorically, how far can typography communicate a feeling, a sound, an expression, a sort of ambiance, an atmosphere through lettering. And I ended up building the first retrospective of Massin's work in the US. But most importantly, what I learned is this attitude of the self-made man. You know, he sort of taught himself everything. And he had this incredible curiosity about everything, about objects, about culture, about language, about level of language, all kinds of things that he managed to translate, you know, visually. And I ended up writing a book about him afterwards, after the exhibition, actually. So I feel like he's taken a big part of my life in a way.
You know, it's interesting because these two kind of mentors, or, you know, people that meant, you know, kind of frame your work, are both, when you listen to, is like more like traditional types of design, you know, it's architecture, it's graphic design. But then when I look at your work, you kind of expanded it. And I think on your website, you wrote, "I believe that design is a tool for sustainable transformation, social responsibility, and civic engagement." And so when I you know, looked at all your projects, you always use design, but in particularly a form of participatory design where you engage people. And so, you know, you kind of expanded, I think, the view of design. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess the bridge between this sort of more traditional personality that sort of shaped my knowledge of the discipline or the disciplines was certainly fundamental in to sort of compensate for the lack of training. However, you know, I didn't only stay within these disciplines and wanted to be able to continually expand. I guess I'm sort of curious about, you know, building sideways and expanding the knowledge of designs by being bathed into it. So I suppose I should mention one important moment in my career, which was when I joined Parsons School of Design, because it's where I could combine the sort of vertical sort of discipline oriented and more of an approach to looking at methods, which I was lacking perhaps in working simply within studio settings or project oriented initiatives like the book or the exhibition. But the Parsons School of Design at the time when I joined was working for the Dean's Office. So working within the institution to help it set up a sort of image and message and strategy of thinking about how a school itself, an institution, can become another one than the one it had been born to be, which was a vocational school. And so it required a change of culture. And I was sort of hired to accompany that shift. And a lot of the sort of methods and questioning they had about where design sits and when does it come in and how far can it go, and is this something that you can test in terms of boundaries of topics? Can design explore urban issues, environmental issues? And at the time, it was like 10 years ago. It was like, it seems like things have changed very quickly, but it was only 10 years ago. It was very cutting edge at the time. And why do I say this? Because the notion of participation was very much at the core of their thinking at the time, within the university setting, within their project-based learning, which was emerging at Parsons at the time. And a lot of the new program in masters were very much based on like real project, you know, finding a territory of a field of exploration, a site to work and develop the classes on. So I kind of learned a lot from that sort of bath into an academic setting where a lot of those questions were posed, and continued to take the city from that experience, the topic of the city, as a sort of background or canvas or you know, terrain on which this notion of participation could be tested. The project I launched right after Parsons was actually a community-based, community-oriented experimental project called Exponential, where I I took a lot of what I learned from the school and transferred it into a form of an initiative, a curated initiative, inviting 10 different labs of designers in developing a project that would be based on participation of a local community in collaboration with a city agency and maybe a nonprofit organization on a particular topic. And through this first project, I sort of tested the idea of a participatory model, which meant that we needed to identify a group of users, a group of people that somewhat are concerned by a common problem, which is the hardest thing in any design project that pretends to have this sort of user-oriented or human-centered approach. Or, you know, you have to define, who are we talking about? Like, are we talking about the people, which is the tendency in France? I hear a lot about the people, the public. And it's like, what public? Who are you talking about? Were you talking about a specific neighborhood, or is it something they share that they have in common? Is this like a gender base or another form of you know, common interest? I sort of tried to develop this approach in all the subsequent projects that I ended up either building or being asked to develop or direct with various organizations. And I still believe there's still so much work to be done. It's about power sharing. It's about giving voice to people who typically have little opportunity to really express themselves. And a lot of the projects I've done are very much about that, like giving voice to people that do not have an opportunity to share their view on things.
I was listening to you and thinking about all the projects that I know you've been working on, and that one on the, you know, the voice part. I think the one you did in Brownsville with NYPD and the SVA and the underserved communities in Brooklyn is a good example. So I was thinking if you could share a little bit about like how you worked on this. And then I think as a counterpart in terms of thinking about different geographies and different communities, I know you've done also work in Nice, in south of France, also around cities and in that case safety, I believe. So if you could talk about these two projects and kind of show how you engaged and at what time and what were the power issues coming up.
Mm-hmm, sure. No, it's interesting that you mentioned these projects because they somewhat connect on you know, on various levels. The first level being the theme of security and safe spaces in communities that are that have been either the sad stage of attacks or high crime rates for a community like Brownsville and Brooklyn. But basically, both were developed in the context of a pedagogical structure. So that's important to mention as well, I think, even though the Nice project is opening up new roles for me, which is really interesting, consulting on this issue of security by design, which has become a bit of a sort of a coined term. But the security issue in Brownsville started with a collaboration with Town and Gown, which is a applied research platform that is sitting within the City of New York Department of Building. And I've been collaborating with the director, Terry Matthews, for many years, connecting academia with municipal services. It's a model that I actually aspire to continue building in France, as a matter of fact. And that Town and Gown had asked me if I was interested in collaborating with NYPD in Brooklyn to explore how to continue a conversation around facilitating a better anchoring of the police stations within neighborhoods that were, you know, as I said, problematic with high crime rates, high level of poverty, high concentration of homelessness, housing, lots of kids leaving high school really early, etc. And the partnership with the NYPD was following a partnership that had been established at the time with Pratt Institute around building a new precinct in Brooklyn, rethinking the Precinct 73, which is in Brownsville. And we came after that, a year after, more on the sort of soft side, if I may say, through the program of SVA called Impact Design for Social Change, which is a summer program I taught at for about 6-7 years. And every summer we would sort of come in and try to figure out how we can facilitate communication design, graphic design, strategy at the service of improvement of either the communication of local organizations or, in this case, NYPD. So we came into an existing, you know, project that had a little bit of history, but we also came in with our own method of, first of all, understanding the players in Brownsville, and not just the police. We had access to the police officers, which was amazing. Innovative technique of what they called community policing had been tested in LA and was started to be brought back in New York. Basically what it meant is that the policemen were not just in their cars driving around the neighborhood, but rather walking. And that was a huge revolution for the building of trust in the community that had a really bad rep. I mean, Brownsville, unfortunately, has this bad rep of being a tough place. And so we spent a lot of time trying to understand what people felt about the police and how they related to that space of the precinct, particularly the symbol of this building that was happened to be built in the 80s as a terrible looking bunker. Absolutely not inviting, not engaging, almost like military type of barracks. And we worked a lot around identifying partners within the social service realm that were connected to the life of people and how to create through this dialogue with them, not only understanding their needs in relation to the police, but also understanding their movement physically in the neighborhood and what motivated them to connect with the police or not. And anyway, the project sort of gave birth to this proposition called Change the Story Brownsville that was very much about building a communication tool that could go both ways, where the police could talk to people about what they wanted to elevate news-wise or opportunity or... but also that the police would become the channel through which the community could tell their story. So we imagined a bulletin board that would actually be co-created, where the content would be actually built on both sides, as opposed to always have this sort of top-down approach of the police that would like tweeting 1,000 tweet a day to say basically nothing to the community. And the community feeling like nobody was listening to them. Nobody knew what was going on. It was not just bad news. There were a lot of independent projects, community gardens, beautiful art, lots of murals in Brownsville that were sort of also the expression of that community. So we worked a lot around this facilitation, the graphic designer as the facilitator, the elevation of this voice, giving it a shape and a process. And we basically, the students were really amazing at setting up a sort of communication strategy that went all the way to hiring a person in the police department that would actually have that role of being the community communication manager. The impact of this project, a year later, the RFPs of the next police precinct that were built in neighborhoods like the Bronx, other parts of Brooklyn, literally took inspiration from our project to embed the notion that there should be in every precinct a place for community connection, communication and connection. Connection meaning not just a place where you arrive and you're behind a glass and there's a policeman that's angry behind, but rather a place where you can actually imagine other services that are connected to the reason why people are searching a safe place. For instance, a lot of these precincts find themselves being located in bank deserts, food deserts and bank deserts, which means that when you go out and take cash in any sort of bank teller station, it's dangerous. There's no protection. And so one of the ideas that the police had suggested was that to use the precinct lobby as a place where you could have a cash machine. When I arrived in Nice, and I moved back to France where I grew up, in the south of France, I ended up teaching very quickly at Bizign, the sustainable design school, where I've been involved very much since my coming back. And the syllabus in this school is based around, you know, the values of this sort of very holistic, integrated vision of the designer having to take the planet into account, but also a sort of a learn by doing model where the classes are built around partnerships that are established with local enterprises, international global groups, as well as collectivité territoriale, which means government, local government. The city of Nice at the time, in this first partnership course, had gained a huge European budget for an initiative called Pacte Sur that they shared with Torino in Italy and Liège in Belgium. And the idea was for those three cities to compare notes and learn from each other, build some best practice and impact, you know, policy regulations around how those cities that had been the victims of terrorist attacks or violent attacks on public space rethink, among other things, their relationship to their citizens and figuring out how the participatory model could be a solution to building more of a trust base around these issues of security in public space. So we ended up being embarked in this very ambitious project. And one of the first thing I asked when I arrived was, can I meet the policeman? Ah, no, impossible. No, we don't do this here. Police is traumatized by the attack of July 2016. You can't talk to them. They don't like to talk about their experience, and we're not going to have you interact with them. So I was like, okay, well, we're going to start from the other way around. We're going to try to be on the streets and meet with the people that have lived this trauma or not. Maybe there's just a memory of it and how it informs the way the Promenade des Anglais, which is this UNESCO-protected site along the Méditerranée, has become an icon and is celebrated as such. And this is where the attack took place. So there was sort of break into this image, right? This perfect image of the Côte d'Azur being the sort of desirable destination. So we worked a lot around looking at the site and trying to meet people right there. But the Promenade des Anglais is 7 kilometers long. So it also means very different things according to where you enter it. But the students ended up going all the way to the end of the promenade and met different people, including migrants. And it happened so that most of them, 90% of them, actually came to France because they were the victim of terrorism in their own country. So we were suddenly like facing a strange, again, a human experience that was completely shifting our perspective on what is considered danger. Are they dangerous, or are they themselves afraid of the danger they might be a victim of? They have been victim of, and that they're perceived as dangerous on the streets. So it was this whole relationship about who informs the shaping of the city as in a sort of general object, also a sense of place, a sense of safety on that place. But what do you, how do you leave trace also of a memory of something that's been so traumatic and that continues to be traumatic for the families of victims? How does design can actually somewhat play a role in either breaking the taboo of these conversations that had been stopped, quiet, because it was too painful and too dangerous to shake these conversations. Whereas in fact, a lot of people were asking for a memorial that would be representative of their feelings and how they relate to this moment in their lives. We also use participation in terms of building tools of engagement with those people that were not verbal necessarily. So we built a series of games that could actually facilitate conversation around the notion of security, about terrorism, about what constitutes terrorism, about violence, about different forms of violence. And we tested the games at various stages. And because the project was really set up with the partnership of the European community, we actually had access to police experts and security experts that were gathering twice a year around this project. So the students were able to test their projects with those people. And it was quite interesting to see how the response was amazing. And it's like, oh, wow, yeah, it's true. Like you can actually trigger things and look at the problem completely differently from these games that were interactive, that were also able to gather data for the students to notice the qualitative reactions and behavior of these users. My epiphany is, I suppose, between the New York experience of the police in Brooklyn and the European conversation around these issues is, wow, this is a topic that is so vast and that touches on so many different aspects of our lives. It's almost like vertigo, you know, when you think about all the different ways in which you're concerned by these issues of security.
Thank you so much for sharing all of this. One thing that that was kind of my last question, and I think that these two projects are really highlighting that, is like this notion of cross-sector collaboration, or these two projects, and I think most of your projects have this kind of multiple partners involved in them. And maybe one way of thinking about this cross-sector collaboration based on your experience is really, how do you see the role as a designer within this collaborative process? What I've heard also on this project is really design as a process and a platform for connecting. But so I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's often that I, and maybe it's, I don't know what to what extent it's because I'm not a designer, that I feel like I'm more in this role of the chef d'orchestre, the coordinator of a different talents that are glued. I always say that the designer is the glue of these different parts that are gravitating without necessarily knowing that they are part of the same environment or ecosystem. But I think this vision that's like systemic and that tried to really think about actors and what are the roles that these different actors could play, and just the sort of high consciousness that I'm trying to instigate in my students' minds every time I start a project is like to stay open-minded about who is concerned. And all these different exercises that we have all practiced in our courses, like such as the stakeholder mapping, is meaningless unless you really are making it a dynamic conversation and a critical assessment constantly of like saying, okay, fine, you put that name here on the map, but what are you going to do about it? Like, are you going to be connecting with these people? How are you going to connect with them? Are you going to talk to them? Is this going to be one person? Is this going to be a representative of a larger constituency? What role are you eventually considering for them to play in this environment? So I can think of, I suppose, an example that was interesting because it's such a large scale, maybe like, going back to this notion of large scale, micro scale, I'm trying to work on both fronts. On the large scale, I've been associated with the Cité du Design in Saint-Étienne, which is a sort of research center and school that's based in the center of France and that has produced a biennale since 1999. And I've been invited to participate in this biennale in one way or another, either as a curator or as a exhibit or colloquium or conference producer or moderator. And a lot of these conversations happen within that sort of moment of activating a network that the city of Saint-Étienne is part of. And the network is called the UNESCO Creative Cities of Design. And it is today composed of about 30 plus cities all around the world that really it's hard to figure out, like, what do they have in common other than their love of design as again, a tool for transformation, a tool, a factor of economic and social development. So how do you activate a network like this when you have cities that are, you know, including Saint-Étienne, Berlin, Buenos Aires, Montreal, and Nagoya? And but the idea was that it had to be multiple, it had to include multiple actors, and the designer needed to be that sort of community glue, the maker of a form. It could be a service, it could be an installation, it could be a new product, it could be a set of furniture on the street, but it had to be gelling that sort of dynamic between different groups that were not really talking to each other. So it was interesting to see the difficulty that we had in communicating these practices to the different cities. And when I say to the cities, usually there was a mayor that was, you know, showing up at the Biennale. And we decided at the end of the whole project, which we showcased in an exhibition that lasted for about a month in the context of the Biennale, to have the mayor come for a colloquium where we sort of debriefed on like what they had learned and trying to assess, you know, what had changed in their perception of the role of the designer as a community leader, but also a mediator. And we had them sign a petition, more like a chart, a sort of official manifesto saying, we will dedicate a person within the city to approach, you know, design from this point of view of the mediator. It's also by these sort of symbolic gesture that you can also change culture and perception of where the designer can come in that front.
Thank you so much. For me, as I'm kind of trying to wrap my head about around all these projects and conversation, it seems that it's really coming out as design as a process rather and a tool for change rather than just a thing, or an outcome or even a set of skills, and really a process that is enacted through, you know, interactions with multiple actors. And you know, from your own personal experience, really the importance of curiosity and passion. And I think learning by doing is clearly something you do with your students, but that you're kind of practicing for yourself. So thank you so much for this inspiring conversation.
Sure. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to the Design Thinking Roundtable podcast produced by the Social Innova Hub, the SIS Lab at Nova SBE, in partnership with the Design Lab at NYU Makerspace. If you think this episode may be of interest for someone in your community, share it and don't forget to tag us. Our Twitter handles are Social Innova Hub and NYU Makerspace. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.